Wilson looked like Dondi, that homeless waif with the big eyes in the comic strips. Clark, $62.17. Keys being punched. The machine rumbled as Sonny hit the total key. "That's a real fall-off," Sonny remarked. "I'll talk to him, never fear. Now please don't chatter at me, Sonny. Mr. Sloat arrives in Muncie at 10:15, and it's a long drive. I don't want to be late." "Sorry, Reverend Gardner." Gardner made some reply Jack didn't even hear. At the name Sloat, a great shock had walloped him. And yet part of him was unsurprised. Part of him had known this might be in the cards. Gardner had been suspicious from the first. He had not wanted to bother his boss with trivialities, Jack figured. Or maybe he had not wanted to admit he couldn't get the truth out of Jack without help. But at last he had called. Where? East? West? Jack would have given a great lot just then to know. Had Morgan been in Los Angeles or New Hampshire? "Hello, Mr. Sloat. I hope I'm not disturbing you, but the local police have brought me a boy, two boys, actually, but it's only the intelligent one I'm concerned with. I seem to know him. Or perhaps it's my other self who knows him. He gives his name as Jack Parker, but what? Describe him? All right." And the balloon had gone up. "Please don't chatter at me, Sonny. Mr. Sloat arrives in Muncie at 10:15. Time had almost run out. I told you to get your ass home, Jack. Too late now. All boys are bad. It's axiomatic." Jack raised his head a tiny bit and looked across the room. Gardner and Sonny Singer sat together on the far side of the desk in Gardner's basement office. Sonny was punching the keys of an adding machine as Gardner gave him set after set of figures, each figure following the name of an outside staffer, each name neatly set in alphabetical order. In front of Sunlight Gardner was a ledger, a long steel file box, and an untidy stack of envelopes. As Gardner held one of these envelopes up to read the amount scribbled on the front, Jack was able to see the back. There was a drawing of two happy children, each carrying a Bible, skipping down the road toward a church, hand in hand. Written below them was, "I'll be a sunbeam for Jesus." Temkin, $106 even. The envelope went into the steel file box with the others that had been recorded. "I think he's been skimming again," Sonny said. "God sees the truth, but waits," Gardner said mildly. "Victor's all right. Now shut up and let's get this done before 6. Sonny punched the keys. The picture of Jesus walking on the water had been swung outward, revealing a safe behind it. The safe was open. Jack saw that there were other things of interest on Sunlight Gardner's desk— two envelopes, one marked Jack Parker and the other Philip Jack Wolf, and his good old pack. The third thing was Sunlight Gardner's bunch of keys. From the keys, Jack's eyes moved to the locked door on the left-hand side of the room, Gardner's private exit to the outside, he knew. If only there was a way. Yellen, $62.19. Gardner sighed, put the last envelope into the long steel tray, and closed his ledger. Apparently Heck was right. I believe our dear friend Mr. Jack Parker has awakened. He got up, came around the desk, and walked toward Jack. His mad, hazy eyes glittered. He reached into his pocket and came out with a lighter. Jack felt a panic rise inside him at the sight of it. "Only... your name isn't really Parker at all, is it, my dear boy? Your real name is Sawyer, isn't it? Oh, yes, Sawyer. And someone with a great interest in you is going to arrive very, very soon. And we'll have all sorts of interesting things to tell him, won't we?" Sunlight Gardner tittered and flicked back the Zippo's hood, revealing the blackened wheel, the smoke-darkened wick. "Confession is so good for the soul," he whispered, and struck a light. Thud. "What was that?" Rudolph asked, looking up from his bank of double ovens. Supper, 15 large turkey pies, was coming along nicely. "What was what?" George Irwinson asked. At the sink, where he was peeling potatoes, Donnie Keegan uttered his loud yuck-yuck of a laugh. "I didn't hear anything," Irwinson said. Donnie laughed again. Rudolph looked at him, irritated. "You gonna peel those goddamn potatoes down to nothing, you idiot?" Thud. "There, you heard it that time, didn't you?" Irwinson only shook his head. Rudolph was suddenly afraid. Those sounds were coming from the box, which, of course, he was supposed to believe was a hay-drying shed. Some fat chance. That big boy was in the box. The one they were saying had been caught in sodomy that morning with his friend. The one who had tried to bribe their way out only the day before. They said the big boy had shown a mean streak before Bast whopped him one, and some of them were also saying that the big boy hadn't just broken Bast's hand, they were saying he had squeezed it to a pulp. That was a lie, of course, had to be, but thud. This time Irwinson looked around, and suddenly Rudolph decided he needed to go to the bathroom, and that maybe he would go all the way up to the third floor to do his business, and not come back out for 2, maybe 3 hours. He felt the approach of black work, very black work. Thud, thud. Fuck the turkey pies. Rudolph took off his apron, tossed it on the counter over the salt cod he had been freshening for tomorrow night's supper, and started out of the room. "Where are you going?" Irwinson asked. His voice was suddenly too high. It trembled. Donnie Keegan went right on furiously peeling potatoes the size of Nerf footballs down to potatoes the size of Spalding golf balls, his dank hair hanging in his face. Thud, 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 thud. Rudolph didn't answer Irwinson's question, and by the time he hit the second floor stairs, he was nearly running. It was hard times in Indiana. Work was scarce, and Sunlight Gardner paid cash. All the same, Rudolph had begun to wonder if the time to look for a new job had not come. Could you say, "Get me out of here"? Thud. The bolt at the top of the box's Dutch oven-type door snapped in two. For a moment there was a dark gap between the box and the door. Silence for a time. Then, thud. The bottom bolt creaked, bent. Thud. It snapped. The door of the box creaked open on its big, clumsy, homemade hinges. 2 huge, heavily pelted feet poked out, soles up. Long claws dug into the dust. Wolf started to work his way out. Back and forth the flame went in front of Jack's eyes. Back and forth, back and forth. Sunlight Gardner looked like a cross between a stage hypnotist and some old-time actor playing the lead in the biography of a great scientist on the Late Late Show. Paul Muni, maybe. It was funny. If he hadn't been so terrified, Jack would have laughed. And maybe he would laugh anyway. "Now, I have a few questions for you, and you are going to answer them," Gardner said. "Mr. Morgan could get the answers out of you himself, oh, easily, indubitably, but I prefer not to put him to the trouble. So, how long have you been able to migrate?" "I don't know what you mean." "How long have you been able to migrate to the territories?" "I don't know what you're talking about." The flame came closer. "Where's the nigger?"
"Who?"
"The nigger! The nigger!" Gardner shrieked. "Parker, Parkus, whatever he calls himself. Where is he?"
"I don't know who you're talking about."
"Sonny! Andy!" Gardner screamed. "Unlace his left hand. Hold it out to me." Warwick bent over Jack's shoulder and did something. A moment later, they were peeling Jack's hand away from the small of his back. It tingled with pins and needles, waking up. Jack tried to struggle, but it was useless. They held his hand out. "Now spread his fingers open." Sonny pulled Jack's ring finger and his pinky in one direction. Warwick pulled his pointer and middle finger in the other. A moment later, Gardner had applied the Zippo's flame to the webbing at the base of the V they had created. The pain was exquisite, bolting up his left arm and from there seeming to fill his whole body. A sweet, charring smell drifted up. Himself, burning, himself. After an eternity, Gardner pulled the Zippo back and snapped it shut. Fine beads of sweat covered his forehead. He was panting. "Devils scream before they come out," he said. "Oh, yes, indeed they do. Don't they, boys?" "Yes, praise God," Warwick said. "You pounded that nail," Sonny said. "Oh, yes, I know it. Yes, indeed I do. I know the secrets of both boys and devils." Gardner tittered, then leaned forward until his face was an inch from Jack's. The cloying scent of cologne filled Jack's nose. Terrible as it was, he thought it was quite a lot better than his own burning flesh. "Now, Jack, how long have you been migrating? Where is the nigger? How much does your mother know? Who have you told? What has the nigger told you? We'll start with those."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
Gardner bared his teeth in a grin. "Boys," he said, "we're going to get sunlight in this boy's soul yet. Lace up his left arm again and unlace his right." Sunlight Gardner opened his lighter again and waited for them to do it, his thumb resting lightly on the striker wheel. George Irwinson and Donnie Keegan were still in the kitchen.
"Someone's out there," George said nervously.
Donnie said nothing. He had finished peeling the potatoes and now stood by the ovens for their warmth. He didn't know what to do next. Confession was being held just down the hall, he knew, and that's where he wanted to be. Confession was safe, and here in the kitchen he felt very, very nervous. But Rudolph hadn't dismissed them. "Best to stay right here."
"I heard someone," George said.
Donnie laughed. "Jesus, that laugh of yours barfs me out," George said. "I got a new Captain America funny book under my mattress. If you take a look out there, I'll let you read it." Donnie shook his head and honked his donkey laugh again. George looked toward the door. Sounds. Scratching. That's what it sounded like, scratching at the door. Like a dog that wanted to be let in. A lost, homeless pup. Except what sort of lost, homeless pup scratched near the top of a door that was nearly 7 feet tall? George went to the window and looked out. He could see almost nothing in the gloom. The box was just a darker shadow amid shadows. George moved toward the door. Jack shrieked so loud and so hard, he thought that surely his throat would rupture. Now Casey had also joined them, Casey with his big swinging gut, and that was a good thing for them, because now it took three of them, Casey, Warwick, and Sonny Singer, to grapple with Jack's arm and keep his hand applied to the flame. When Gardner drew it away this time, there was a black, bubbling, blistered patch the size of a quarter on the side of Jack's hand. Gardner got up, took the envelope marked Jack Parker from his desk, and brought it back. He brought out the guitar pick. "What's this?"
"A guitar pick," Jack managed. His hands were burning agony.
"What is it in the territories?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"What's this?"
"A marble. What are you, blind?"
"Is it a toy in the territories?"
"I don't—"
"Is it a mirror?"
"No."
"Is it a top that disappears when you spin it fast?"
"What you're—"
"You do! You do, too, you faggot hellbound whelp!"
"Talking about?"
Gardner drove a hand across Jack's face. He brought out the silver dollar. His eyes gleamed. "What's this?"
"It's a lucky piece from my Aunt Helen."
"What is it in the territories?"
"Box of Rice Krispies."
Gardner held up the lighter. "Your last chance, boy."
"It turns into a vibraphone and plays crazy rhythm."
"Hold out his right hand again," Gardner said. Jack struggled, but at last they got his hand out. In the oven, the turkey pies had begun to burn. George Irwinson had been standing by the door for almost 5 minutes, trying to get up nerve enough to open it. That scratching noise had not been repeated.
"Well, I'll show you there's nothing to be afraid of, chicken guts," George said heartily. "When you're strong in the Lord, there's never any need to be afraid."
With this grand statement, he threw open the door.
A huge, shaggy, shadowy thing stood on the threshold, its eyes blazing red from deep sockets. George's eyes tracked one paw as it rose in the windy autumn dark and wickered down. 6-inch claws gleamed in the kitchen's light. They tore George Irwinson's head from his neck, and his head flew across the room, spraying blood, to strike the shoes of the laughing Donnie Keegan. The madly laughing Donnie Keegan. Wolf leaped into the kitchen, dropping down to all fours. He passed Donnie Keegan with hardly a look, and ran into the hall.
Wolf! Wolf! Right here and now!
It was Wolf's voice in his mind, all right, but it was deeper, richer, more commanding than Jack had ever heard it. It cut through the haze of pain in his mind like a fine Swedish knife. He thought Wolf is riding with the moon. The thought brought a mixture of triumph and sorrow. Sunlight Gardner was looking upward, his eyes narrowed. In that moment he looked very much like a beast himself, a beast who has scented danger downwind. "Reverend?" Sonny asked. Sonny was panting slightly, and the pupils of his eyes were very large. "He's been enjoying himself," Jack thought. "If I start to talk, Sonny's going to be disappointed."
"I heard something," Gardner said. "Casey, go and listen in the kitchen and the common room."
"Right," Casey took off. Gardner looked back at Jack. "I'm going to have to leave for Muncie soon," he said, "and when I meet Mr. Morgan, I want to be able to give him some information immediately. So you had better talk to me, Jack. Spare yourself further pain."
Jack looked at him, hoping the jackhammer beat of his heart didn't show either in his face or as a faster, more noticeable pulse in his neck. If Wolf was out of the box... Gardner held up the pick Speedy had given him in one hand, the coin Captain Farron had given him in the other. "What are they?"
"When I flip, they turn into tortoise testicles," Jack said, and laughed wildly, hysterically. Gardner's face darkened with angry blood. "Lace up his arms again," he said to Sonny and Andy. "Lace up his arms and then pull down this hell-bound bastard's pants. Let's see what happens when we heat up his testicles."
Heck Bast was deathly bored with confession. He had heard them all before, these paltry mail-order sins. "I hooked money from my mother's purse. I used to blow joints in the schoolyard. We used to put glue in a paper bag and sniff it. I did this, I did that." Little kids' stuff. No excitement. Nothing to take his mind off the steady drone of pain in his hand. Heck wanted to be downstairs, working on that kid Sawyer. And then they could get started on the big retard who had somehow surprised him and destroyed his good right hand. Yes, getting to work on the big retard would be a real pleasure, preferably with a set of bolt cutters. A boy named Vernon Scarda was currently droning away. "So me and him, we seen the keys was in her, know what I mean? So he goes, 'Let's jump in the horn, drive her around the block,' he goes. 'But I knew it was wrong, and I said it was.' So he goes, 'You ain't nothing but a chicken shit.' So I go, 'I ain't no chicken shit,' like that. So he goes, 'Prove it, prove it. I ain't doing no joyride,' I go. So he goes, 'Oh, dear Christ,' Heck thought. His hand was really starting to yell at him, and his pain pills were up in his room. On the far side of the room, he saw Peabody stretch his jaws in a bone-cracking yawn. "So we went around the block, and then he goes to me, he goes, 'The door suddenly slammed inward so hard it tore off its hinges. It hit the wall, bounced, struck a boy named Tom Cassidy, drove him to the floor and pinned him there. Something leaped into the common room. At first, Heck Bass thought it was the biggest motherfucking dog he had ever seen. Boys screamed and bolted up from their chairs, and then froze, eyes wide and unbelieving, as the gray-black beast that was Wolf stood upright, shreds of chinos and checked shirt still clinging to him. Vernon Scarda stared, eyes bulging, jaws hanging. Wolf bellowed, eyes glaring around, as the boys fell back from him. Peterson made for the door. Wolf, towering so high his head almost brushed the ceiling, moved with liquid speed. He swung an arm as thick as a barn beam. Claws tore a channel through Peterson's back. For a moment, his spine was clearly visible. It looked like a bloody extension cord. Gore splashed the walls. Peterson took one great shambling step out into the hall and then collapsed. Wolf turned back, and his blazing eyes fastened on Heck Bast. Heck got up suddenly on nerveless legs, staring at this shaggy, red-eyed horror. He knew who it was, or at least who it had been. Heck would have given anything in the world just then to be bored again. Jack was sitting in the chair again, his burned and throbbing hands once more pressed against the small of his back. Sonny had laced the straitjacket cruelly tight and then unbuttoned Jack's chinos and pushed them down. "Now," Gardner said, holding his Zippo up where Jack could see it, "you listen to me, Jack, and listen well. I'm going to begin asking you questions again, and if you don't answer them well and truly, then buggery is one temptation you will never have to worry about being led into again." Sonny Singer giggled wildly at this. That muddy, half-dead look of lust was back in his eyes again. He stared at Jack's face with a kind of sickly greed. "Reverend Gardner! Reverend Gardner!" It was Casey, and Casey sounded distressed. Jack opened his eyes again. "Some kind of hoorah going on upstairs." "I don't want to be bothered now. Donnie Keegan's laughing like a loon in the kitchen, and he said he didn't want to be bothered now," Sonny said. "Didn't you hear him?" But Casey was too dismayed to stop. "And it sounds like there's a riot going on in the common room, yelling, screaming, and it sounds like..." Suddenly Jack's mind filled with a bellow of incredible force and vitality.
"Jackie, where are you, Wolf? Where are you? Right here and now."
"There's a dog pack or something loose up there."
Gardner was looking at Casey now, eyes narrow, lips pressed tightly together.
"Gardner's office, downstairs where we were before."
"Downside, Jackie?"
"Stairs, downstairs, Wolf."
"Right here and now."
That was it. Wolf was gone from his head. From upstairs, Jack heard a thump and a scream.
"Reverend Gardner?"
Casey asked. His normally flushed face was deeply pale.
"Reverend Gardner, what is it? What?
Shut up!" Gardner said. And Casey recoiled as if slapped, eyes wide and hurt, considerable jowls trembling. Gardner brushed past him and went to the safe. From it he took an outsized pistol, which he stuck in his belt. For the first time, the Reverend Sunlight Gardner looked scared and baffled. Upstairs, there was a dim, shattering sound, followed by a screech. The eyes of Singer, Warwick, and Casey all turned nervously upward. They looked like nervous bomb shelter occupants listening to a growing whistle above them. Gardner looked at Jack. A grin surfaced on his face, the corners of his mouth twitching irregularly, as if strings were attached to them, strings that were being pulled by a puppeteer who wasn't particularly good at his job. "He'll come here, won't he?" Sunlight Gardner said. He nodded as if Jack had answered. "He'll come, but I don't think he'll leave." Wolf leaped. Heck Bast was able to get his right hand in its plaster cast up in front of his throat. There was a hot flash of pain, a brittle crunch, and a puff of plaster dust as Wolf bit the cast and what was left of the hand inside it off. Heck looked stupidly down at where it had been. Blood jetted from his wrist. It soaked his white turtleneck with bright, hot warmth.
"Please," Heck whined, "please, please don't,"
Wolf spat out the hand. His head moved forward with the speed of a striking snake. Heck felt a dim pulling sensation as Wolf tore his throat open, and then he knew no more. As he bolted out of the common room, Peabody skidded in Peterson's blood, went down to one knee, got up, and then ran down the first floor hall as fast as he could go, vomiting all over himself as he went. Kids were running everywhere, shrieking in panic. Peabody's own panic was not quite that complete. He remembered what he was supposed to do in extreme situations, although he didn't think anyone had ever envisioned a situation as extreme as this. He had an idea that Reverend Gardner had been thinking in terms of a kid going bug-fuck and cutting another kid up, something like that. Beyond the parlor where new boys were brought when they first came to the Sunlight Home was a small upstairs office, used only by the thugs Gardner referred to as his student aides. Peabody locked himself in this room, picked up the phone, and dialed an emergency number. A moment later, he was talking to Frankie Williams. "Peabody, at the Sunlight Home," he said. "You ought to get up here with as many police as you can get, Officer Williams. All hell has..." Outside, he heard a wailing shriek, followed by a crash of breaking wood. There was a snarling, barking roar, and the shriek was cut off. "Has busted loose up here," he finished. "What kind of hell?" Williams asked impatiently. "Let me talk to Gardner." "I don't know where the Reverend is, but he'd want you up here. There's people dead. Kids dead." "What?" "Just get up here with a lot of men," Peabody said, "and a lot of guns." Another scream. The crash thud of something heavy, the old high boy in the front hall probably, being overturned. "Machine guns, if you can find them." A crystalline jangle as the big chandelier in the hall came down. Peabody cringed. It sounded like that monster was tearing the whole place apart with its bare hands. "Hell, bring a nuke if you can," Peabody said, beginning to blubber. "What?" Peabody hung up before Williams could finish. He crawled into the knee hole under the desk, wrapped his arms around his head, and began to pray assiduously that all of this should prove to be only a dream, the worst fucking nightmare he had ever had. Wolf raged along the first floor hall between the common room and the front door, pausing only to overturn the high boy, then to leap easily up and grab the chandelier. He swung on it like Tarzan until it tore out of the ceiling and spilled diamonds of crystal all over the hallway runner.
Downside. Jackie was on the downside.
Now, which side was that? A boy who was no longer able to stand the agonizing tension of waiting for the thing to be gone jerked open the door of the closet where he'd been hiding and bolted for the stairs. Wolf grabbed him and threw him the length of the hall. The boy struck the closed kitchen door with a bone-breaking thud and fell in a heap. Wolf's head swam with the intoxicating odor of fresh-spilled blood. His hair hung in bloody dreadlocks around his jaw and muzzle. He tried to hold on to thought, but it was hard, hard. He had to find Jackie very quickly now, before he lost the ability to think completely. He raced back toward the kitchen where he had come in, dropping to all fours again because movement was faster and easier that way, and suddenly, passing a closed door, he remembered. The narrow place. It had been like going down into a grave, the smell wet and heavy in his throat.
Downside. Behind that door, right here and now. Wolf! He cried.
Although the boys, cringing in their hiding places on the first and second floors, heard only a rising, triumphant howl. He raised both of the heavily muscled battering rams that had been his arms and drove them into the door. It burst open in the middle, vomiting splinters down the stairwell. Wolf drove his way through, and yes, here was the narrow place, like a throat. Here was the way to the place where the white man had told his lies, while Jack and the weaker Wolf had to sit and listen. Jack was down there now. Wolf could smell him. But he also smelled the white man, and gunpowder.
Careful.
Oh, yes, Wolf's knew careful. Wolves could run and tear and kill, but when they had to be... Wolf's new careful. He went down the stairs on all fours, silent as oiled smoke, eyes as red as brake lights. Gardner was becoming steadily more nervous. To Jack, he looked like a man who was entering the freak-out zone. His eyes moved jerkily in a triple play from the studio where Casey was frantically listening to Jack, and then to the closed door which gave on the hall. Most of the noises from upstairs had stopped some time ago. Now Sonny Singer started for the door.
"I'll go up and see what's..." "You're not going anywhere. Come back here."
Sonny winced, as if Gardner had struck him.
"What's the matter, Reverend Gardner?" Jack asked.
You look a little nervous.
Sonny rocked him with a slap.
You ought to watch the way you talk, Snotface. You just want to watch it.
You look nervous too, Sonny. And you, Warwick. And Casey in there.
Shut him up!
Gardner suddenly screamed.
Can't you do anything? Do I have to do everything around here myself?
Sonny slapped Jack again, much harder. Jack's nose began to bleed, but he smiled. Wolf was very close now, and Wolf was being careful. Jack had begun to have a crazy hope that they might get out of this alive. Casey suddenly straightened up and then tore the cans off his head and flicked the intercom switch.
Reverend Gardner, I hear sirens on the outside mics.
Gardner's eyes, now too wide, skidded back to Casey.
What? How many? How far away?
Sounds like a lot, Casey said. Not close yet, but they're coming here, no doubt about that.
Gardner's nerve broke then. Jack saw it happen. The man sat, indecisive, for a moment, and then he wiped his mouth delicately with the side of his hand. It isn't whatever happened upstairs. Not just the sirens, either. He knows that Wolf is close, too. In his own way, he smells him, and he doesn't like it.
Wolf, we might have a chance. We just might.
Gardner handed the pistol to Sonny Singer.
I haven't time to deal with the police or whatever mess there might be upstairs right now, he said. The important thing is Morgan Sloat. I'm going to Muncie. You and Andy are coming with me, Sonny. You keep this gun on our friend Jack here while I get the car out of the garage. When you hear the horn, come on out.
What about Casey? Andy Warwick rumbled.
Yes, yes, all right, Casey too, Gardner agreed at once. And Jack thought, he's running out on you, you stupid assholes. He's running out on you. It's so obvious that he might as well take out a billboard on the Sunset Strip and advertise the fact, and your brains are too blown to even know it. You'd go on sitting down here for 10 years waiting to hear that horn blow if the food and toilet paper held out that long.
Gardner got up. Sonny Singer, his face flushed with new importance, sat down behind his desk and pointed the gun at Jack.
If his retarded friend shows up, Gardner said, shoot him.
How could he show up? Sonny asked. He's in the box.
Never mind, Gardner said. He's evil. They're both evil. It's indubitable. It's axiomatic. If the retard shows up, shoot him. Shoot them both. He fumbled through the keys on his ring and selected one.
When you hear the horn, he said.
He opened the door and went out. Jack strained his ears for the sound of sirens, but heard nothing. The door closed behind Sunlight Gardner. Time, stretching out. A minute that felt like 2. 2 that felt like 10. 4 that felt like an hour. The 3 of Gardner's student aides who had been left with Jack looked like boys who had been caught in a game of statue tag. Sonny sat bolt upright behind Sunlight Gardner's desk, a place he both relished and coveted. The gun pointed steadily at Jack's face. Warwick stood by the door to the hall. Casey sat in the brightly lighted booth with the cans on his ears again, staring blankly out through the other glass square, into the darkness of the chapel, seeing nothing, only listening.
"He's not going to take you with him, you know," Jack said suddenly. The sound of his voice surprised him a little. It was even and unafraid.
"Shut up, Snotface," Sonny snapped.
"Don't hold your breath until you hear him honk that horn," Jack said. "You'll turn pretty blue."
"Next thing he says, Andy, break his nose," Sonny said.
"That's right," Jack said. "Break my nose, Andy. Shoot me, Sonny. The cops are coming. Gardner's gone, and they're going to find the 3 of you standing over a corpse in a straitjacket."
He paused and amended, "a corpse in a straitjacket with a broken nose."
"Hit him, Andy," Sonny said.
Andy Warwick moved from the door to where Jack sat, straight-jacketed, his pants and underpants puddled around his ankles. Jack turned his face openly up to Warwick's.
"That's right, Andy," he said. "Hit me. I'll hold still. Hell of a target."
Andy Warwick balled up his fist, drew it back, and then hesitated. Uncertainty flickered in his eyes. There was a digital clock on Gardner's desk. Jack's eyes shifted to it for a moment, and then back to Warwick's face.
"It's been 4 minutes, Andy. How long does it take a guy to back a car out of the garage, especially when he's in a hurry?"
Sonny Singer bolted out of Sunlight Gardner's chair, came around the desk, and charged at Jack. His narrow, secretive face was furious. His fists were balled up. He made as if to hit Jack. Warwick, who was bigger, restrained him. There was trouble on Warwick's face now. Deep trouble.
"Wait," he said.
"I don't have to listen to this. I don't..." "Why don't you ask Casey how close those sirens are getting?" Jack asked. And Warwick's frown deepened. "You've been left in the lurch. Don't you know that? Do I have to draw you a picture? It's going bad here. He knew it. He smelled it. He's leaving you with a bag." From the sounds upstairs, Singer broke free of Warwick's half-hearted hold and clouted Jack on the side of the face. His head rocked to one side, then came slowly back. "It's a big, messy bag," Jack finished.
"You shut up or I'll kill you," Sonny hissed.
The digits on the clock had changed. 5 minutes now, Jack said.
"Sonny," Warwick said with a catch in his voice, "let's get him out of that thing."
"No!" Sonny's cry was wounded, furious, ultimately frightened.
"You know what the Reverend said," Warwick said rapidly, "before, when the TV people came. Nobody can see the straitjackets. They wouldn't understand." They
click the intercom. "Sonny? Andy?" Casey sounded panicky. "They're closer! The sirens! Christ! What are we supposed to do?"
"Let him out now!"
Warwick's face was pallid, except for two red spots high on his cheekbones.
"Reverend Gardner also said..." "I don't give a fuck what he also said!"
Warwick's voice dropped, and now he voiced the child's deepest fear.
"We're gonna get caught, Sonny! We're gonna get caught!"
And Jack thought that now he could hear sirens. Or perhaps it was only his imagination. Sonny's eyes rolled toward Jack with horrible, trapped indecision. He half raised the gun, and for one moment Jack believed Sonny was really going to shoot him. But it was 6 minutes now, and still no honk from the Godhead, announcing that the Deus Ex Machina was now boarding for Muncie.
"You let him loose," Sonny said sulkily to Andy Warwick. "I don't even want to touch him. He's a sinner, and he's a queer."
Sonny retreated to the desk as Andy Warwick's fingers fumbled with the straitjacket's lacings.
"You better not say anything," he panted. "You better not say anything, or I'll kill you myself."
Right arm free, left arm free. They collapsed bonelessly into his lap, pins and needles coming back. Warwick hauled the hateful restraint off him, a horror of dun-colored canvas and rawhide lacings. Warwick looked at it in his hands and grimaced. He darted across the room and began to stuff it into Sunlight Gardner's safe.
"Pull up your pants," Sonny said. "You think I want to look at your works?"
Jack fumbled up his shorts, got the waistband of his pants, dropped them, and managed to pull them up. Click, the intercom.
"Sonny? Andy?" Casey's voice panicked. "I hear something! Are they turning in?"
Sonny almost screamed. Warwick redoubled his efforts to stuff the straitjacket into the safe.
"Are they turning in the front?" "No! In the chapel! I can't see nothing, but I can hear something in there!"
There was an explosion of shattering glass as Wolf leaped from the darkness of the chapel and into the studio. Casey's screams, as he pushed back from the control board in his wheel-footed chair, were hideously amplified. Inside the studio, there was a brief storm of glass. Wolf landed four-footed on the slanted control board and half-climbed, half-slid down it, his eyes throwing a red glare. His long claws turned dials and flicked switches at random. The big reel-to-reel Sony tape recorder started to turn.
"Communists!"
the voice of Sunlight Gardner bellowed. He was cranked to maximum volume, drowning out Casey's shrieks and Warwick's screams to "shoot it, Sonny, shoot it, shoot it." But the voice of Gardner was not alone. In the background, like music from hell, came the mingled warble of many sirens as Casey's mics picked up a caravan of police cruisers turning into the Sunlight Homes Drive.
"Oh, they're gonna tell you it's all right to look at those dirty books. They're gonna tell you it don't matter that it's against the law to pray in the public schools. They're gonna tell you it don't even matter that there are 16 U.S. representatives and 2 U.S. governors who are avowed homosexuals. They're gonna tell you..."
Casey's chair rolled back against the glass wall between the studio and Sunlight Gardner's office.
His head turned, and for one moment they could all see his agonized, bulging eyes. Then Wolf leaped from the edge of the control panel. His head struck Casey's gut and plowed into it. His jaws began to open and close with the speed of a cane-cutting machine. Blood flew up and splattered the window as Casey began to convulse.
"Shoot it, Sonny! Shoot the fucking thing!" Warwick whooped.
"Think I'm gonna shoot him instead," Sonny said, looking around at Jack. He spoke with the air of a man who has finally arrived at a great conclusion. He nodded, began to grin.
"Day is coming, boys. Oh, yes, a mighty day. And on that day, those communist, humanist, hell-bound atheists are going to find out that the rock will not shield them. The dead tree will not give them shelter. They're gonna, oh, say hallelujah. They're gonna..."
Wolf, snarling and ripping. Sunlight Gardner ranting about communism and humanism, the hell-bound dope pushers who wanted to see that prayer never made it back into the public schools. Sirens from outside, slamming car doors, someone telling someone else to take it slow. The kid had sounded scared.
"Yes, you're the one. You made all this trouble."
He raised the .45. The muzzle of the .45 looked as big as the mouth of the Oatley Tunnel. The glass wall between the studio and the office blew inward with a loud, coughing roar. A gray-black, shaggy shape exploded into the room, its muzzle torn nearly in two by a jag of glass, its feet bleeding. It bellowed an almost human sound, and the thought came to Jack so powerfully that it sent him reeling backward.
"You will not harm the herd."
"Wolf," he wailed, "look out, look out, he's got a—" Sonny pulled the trigger of the .45 twice. The reports were deafening in the closed space. The bullets were not aimed at Wolf, they were aimed at Jack. But they tore into Wolf instead, because at that instant he was between the two boys, in mid-leap. Jack saw huge, ragged, bloody holes open in Wolf's side as the bullets exited. The paths of both slugs were deflected as they pulverized Wolf's ribs, and neither touched Jack, although he felt one whiff past his left cheek.
"Wolf!"
Wolf's dexterous, limber leap had turned awkward. His right shoulder rolled forward, and he crashed into the wall, splattering blood and knocking down a framed photograph of Sunlight Gardner in a Shriner's fez. Laughing, Sonny Singer turned toward Wolf and shot him again. He held the gun in both hands, and his shoulders jerked with the recoil. Gun smoke hung in a thick, noxious, unmoving rafter. Wolf struggled up on all fours, and then rose somehow to his feet. A shattering, wounded bellow of pain and rage overtopped Sunlight Gardner's thundering recorded voice. Sonny shot Wolf a fourth time. The slug tore a gaping hole in his left arm. Blood and gristle flew.
"Jackie! Jackie! Oh, Jackie! Hurts! That hurts me!"
Jack shambled forward and grabbed Gardner's digital clock. It was simply the first thing that came to hand.
"Sonny, look out!" Warwick shouted.
"Look!" Then Wolf, his entire midsection, now a gory tangle of blood-matted hair, pounced on him. Warwick grappled with Wolf, and for a moment they appeared almost to be dancing.
"In a lake of fire forever, for the Bible says..."
Jack brought the digital radio down on Sonny's head with all the force he could muster as Sonny began to turn around. Plastic crunched. The numbers on the front of the clock began to blink randomly. Sonny reeled around, trying to bring the gun up. Jack swung the radio in a flat, rising arc that ended at Sonny's mouth. Sonny's lips flew back in a great funhouse grin. There was a brittle crunch as his teeth broke. His finger jerked the trigger of the gun again. The bullet went between his feet. He hit the wall, rebounded, and grinned at Jack from his bloody mouth. Swaying on his feet, he raised the gun. Hellbound Wolf threw Warwick. Warwick flew through the air with the greatest of ease and struck Sonny in the back as Sonny fired. The bullet went wild, hitting one of the turning tape reels in the sound studio and pulverizing it. The ranting, screaming voice of Sunlight Gardner ceased. A great bass hum of feedback began to rise from the speakers.
Roaring, staggering, Wolf advanced on Sonny Singer. Sonny pointed the .45 at him and pulled the trigger. There was a dry, impotent click. Sonny's wet grin faltered.
"No,"
he said mildly, and pulled the trigger again, and again, and again. As Wolf reached for him, he threw the gun and tried to run around Gardner's big desk. The pistol bounced off Wolf's skull, and with a final, failing burst of strength, Wolf leaped across Sunlight Gardner's desk after Sonny, scattering everything that had been there. Sonny backed away, but Wolf was able to grab his arm.
"No!" Sonny screamed. "No, you better not! You'll go back in the box! I'm a big man around here!
Wolf twisted Sonny's arm. There was a ripping sound, the sound of a turkey drumstick being torn from the cooked bird by an overenthusiastic child. Suddenly, Sonny's arm was in Wolf's big front paw. Sonny staggered away, blood jetting from his shoulder. Jack saw a wet, white knob of bone. He turned away and was violently sick. For a moment, the whole world swam into grayness. When he looked around again, Wolf was swaying in the middle of the carnage that had been Gardner's office. His eyes guttered pale yellow, like dying candles. Something was happening to his face, to his arms and legs. He was becoming Wolf again, Jack saw, and then understood fully what that meant. The old legends had lied about how only silver bullets could destroy a werewolf, but apparently about some things they did not lie. Wolf was changing back because he was dying.
"Wolf, no!"
he wailed, and managed to get to his feet. He got halfway to Wolf, slipped in a puddle of blood, went to one knee, got up again.
"No!"
"Jackie."
The voice was low, guttural, little more than a growl, but understandable. And, incredibly, Wolf was trying to smile. Warwick had gotten Gardner's door open. He was backing slowly up the steps, his eyes wide and shocked.
"Go on!" Jack screamed. "Go on! Get out of here!"
Andy Warwick fled like a scared rabbit. A voice from the intercom, Frankie Williams's voice, cut through the droning buzz of feedback. It was horrified, but filled with a terrible, sickly excitement.
"Christ, look at this! Looks like somebody went bullshit with a meat cleaver! Some of you guys check the kitchen!"
"Jackie!"
Wolf collapsed like a falling tree. Jack knelt, turned him over. The hair was melting away from Wolf's cheeks with the eerie speed of time-lapse photography. His eyes had gone hazel again, and to Jack he looked horribly tired.
"Jackie!"
Wolf raised a bloody hand and touched Jack's cheek.
"Shoot you? Did he?"
"No," Jack said, cradling his friend's head. "No, Wolf, never got me. Never did."
"I..."
Wolf's eyes closed and then opened slowly again. He smiled with incredible sweetness and spoke carefully, enunciating each word, obviously needing to convey this, if nothing else.
"I... kept my herd safe."
"Yes, you did,"
Jack said, and his tears began to flow. They hurt. He cradled Wolf's shaggy, tired head and wept.
"You sure did, good old Wolf."
Good old Jackie."
"Wolf, I'm going to go upstairs. There are cops. An ambulance."
"No."
Wolf once again seemed to rouse himself to a great effort.
"Go on. You go on."
"Not without you, Wolf."
All the lights had blurred double, treble. He held Wolf's head in his burned hands.
"Not without you. Uh-uh. No way.
Wolf doesn't want to live in this world."
He pulled a great, shuddering breath into his broad, shattered chest and tried another smile.
Smells too bad."
"Wolf, listen, Wolf."
Wolf took his hands gently. As he held them, Jack could feel the hair melting from Wolf's palms. It was a ghostly, terrible sensation.
"I love you, Jackie."
"I love you too, Wolf," Jack said, "right here and now."
Wolf smiled. "Going back, Jackie. I can feel it. Going back."
Suddenly Wolf's very hands felt insubstantial in Jack's grip.
"Wolf!"
he screamed.
"Going back home."
"Wolf, no!"
He felt his heart stagger and wrench in his chest. It would break. Oh, yes, hearts could break. He felt that.
"Wolf, come back! I love you!"
There was a sensation of lightness in Wolf now, a feeling that he was turning into something like a milkweed pod, or a shimmer of illusion. A daydream.
"Goodbye."
Wolf was fading glass. Fading. Fading.
"Wolf!"
"Love you, Jack."
Wolf was gone. There was only a bloody outline on the floor where he had been.
"Oh, God," Jack moaned. "Oh, God, oh, God."
He hugged himself and began to rock back and forth in the demolished office, moaning. Chapter 27. Jack lights out again. Time passed. Jack had no idea how much or how little. He sat with his arms wrapped around himself as if he were in the straitjacket again, rocking back and forth, moaning, wondering if Wolf could really be gone. "He's gone. Oh, yes, he's gone. And guess who killed him, Jack? Guess who?" At some point, the feedback hum took on a rasping note. A moment later, there was a high-gain crackle of static, and everything shorted out. Feedback hum, upstairs chatter, idling engines out front. Jack barely noticed.
"Go on." Wolf said to go on. "I can't. I can't. I'm tired. And whatever I do is the wrong thing. People get killed. Quit it, you self-pitying jerk. Think about your mother, Jack." "No, I'm tired. Let me be."
"And the Queen."
"Please, just leave me alone."
At last he heard the door at the top of the stairs open, and that roused him. He did not want to be found here. Let them take him outside, in the backyard, but not in this stinking, blood-spattered, smoky room where he had been tortured and his friend killed. Barely thinking about what he was doing, Jack took up the envelope with Jack Parker written across the front. He looked inside and saw the guitar pick, the silver dollar, his beat-up wallet, the Rand McNally Road Atlas. He tilted the envelope and saw the marble. He stuck everything in the pack and slipped it on, feeling like a boy in a state of hypnosis. Footfalls on the stairs, slow and cautious. "Where's the damn lights? Funny smell, like a zoo. Watch it, boys." Jack's eyes happened on the steel file tray, neatly stacked with envelopes reading, "I'll be a sunbeam for Jesus." He helped himself to two of them. Now when they grab you coming out, they can get you for robbery as well as murder. Didn't matter. He was moving now for the simple sake of movement, no more than that. The backyard appeared completely deserted. Jack stood at the top of the stairs that exited through a bulkhead and looked around, hardly able to believe it. There were voices from the front and pulses of light and occasional smears of static and dispatchers' voices from police radios that had been cranked up all the way to high gain. But the backyard was empty. It made no sense. But he supposed if they were confused enough, rattled enough by what they had found inside. Then a voice, muffled, less than 20 feet away on Jack's left, said, "Christ, do you believe this?" Jack's head snapped around. There, squatting on the beaten dirt like a crude Iron Age coffin, was the box. A flashlight was moving around inside. Jack could see shoe soles sticking out. A dim figure was crouching by the mouth of the box, examining the door. "Looks like this thing was ripped right off in its hinges," the fellow looking at the door called into the box. "I don't know how anyone could have done it, though. Hinges are steel, but they're just twisted." "Never mind the damn hinges," the muffled voice came back. "This goddamn thing, they kept kids in here, Paulie. I really think they did. Kids. There's initials on the walls." The light moved. "And Bible verses." The light moved again. "And pictures. Little pictures. Little stick men and women like kids draw. Christ, do you think Williams knew about this?" "Must have," Polly said, still examining the torn and twisted steel hinges on the box's door. Polly was bending in, his colleague was backing out. Making no special attempt at concealment, Jack walked across the open dooryard behind them. He went along the side of the garage and came out on the shoulder of the road. From here he had an angle on the careless jam of police cars in the Sunlight Home's front yard. As Jack stood watching, an ambulance came tearing up the road, flashers whirling, siren warbling.
"Loved you, Wolf," Jack muttered, and wiped an arm across his wet eyes.
He set off down the road into darkness, thinking he would most likely be picked up before he got a mile west of the Sunlight Home. But 3 hours later he was still walking. Apparently the cops had more than enough to occupy them back there. There was a highway up ahead, over the next rise or the rise after that. Jack could see the orangey glow of high-intensity sodium arcs on the horizon, could hear the whine of the big rigs. He stopped in a trash-littered ravine and washed his face and hands in the trickle of water coming out of a culvert. The water was almost paralyzing cold, but at least it silenced the throbbing in his hands for a while. The old cautions were coming back almost unbidden. Jack stood for a moment where he was, under the dark night sky of Indiana, listening to the whine of the big trucks. The wind, murmuring in the trees, lifted his hair. His heart was heavy with the loss of Wolf, but even that could not change how good, how very good it was to be free. An hour later, a trucker slowed for the tired, pallid boy standing in the breakdown lane with his thumb cocked. Jack climbed in.
"Where you headed, kiddo?" the trucker asked.
Jack was too tired and too sick at heart to bother with the story. He barely remembered it anyway. He supposed it would come back to him. "West," he said. "Far as you're going."
"That'd be mid-state."
"Fine," Jack said, and fell asleep. The big diamond Rio rolled through the chilly Indiana night. Charlie Daniels on the tape player, it rolled west, chasing its own headlights toward Illinois. Chapter 28 Jack's Dream. Of course, he carried Wolf with him. Wolf had gone home, but a big loyal shadow rode beside Jack in all the trucks and Volkswagen vans and dusty cars pounding along the Illinois highways. This smiling ghost pierced Jack's heart. Sometimes he could almost see Wolf's huge, hairy form bounding alongside, romping through the stripped fields. Free, Wolf beamed at him with pumpkin-colored eyes. When he jerked his eyes away, Jack felt the absence of a wolf hand folding itself around his. Now that he missed his friend so completely, the memory of his impatience with Wolf shamed him, brought the blood to his face. He had thought about abandoning Wolf more times than he could count. Shameful, shameful. Wolf had been... It took Jack a time to take it in, but the word was noble. And this noble being, so out of place in this world, had died for him. "I kept my herd safe." Jack Sawyer was the herd no longer. "I kept my herd safe." There were times when the truck drivers or insurance salesmen who had picked up this strange, compelling boy on the side of the road, picked him up even though the boy was road dirty and shaggy, even though they might never have taken on a hitchhiker before in their lives, looked over and saw him blinking back tears. Jack mourned Wolf as he sped across Illinois. He had somehow known that he would have no trouble getting rides once in that state, and it was true that often all he had to do was stick out his thumb and look an oncoming driver in the eye. Instant ride. Most of the drivers did not even demand the story. All he had to do was give some minimal explanation for traveling alone. "I'm going to see a friend in Springfield. I have to pick up a car and drive it back home."
"Great, great," the driver said.
Had they even heard? Jack could not tell.
His mind riffled through a mile-high stack of images of Wolf splashing into a stream to rescue his territory's creatures, Wolf nosing into a fragrant box that had held a hamburger, Wolf pushing food into his shed, bursting into the recording studio, taking the bullets, melting away. Jack did not want to see these things again and again, but he had to, and they made his eyes burn with tears. Not far out of Danville, a short 50-ish man with iron-gray hair and the amused but stern expression of one who has taught fifth grade for 2 decades, kept darting sly looks at him from behind the wheel, then finally said, "Aren't you cold, Buster? You ought to have more than that little jacket." "Maybe a little," Jack said. Sunlight Gardner had thought the denim jackets warm enough for field work right through the winter, but now the weather licked and stabbed right through its pores. "I have a coat on the back seat," the man said. "Take it." "No, don't even try to talk your way out of it. That coat's yours now. Believe me, I won't freeze." "But you have no choice at all in the matter. That is now your coat. Try it on." Jack reached over the back of the seat and dragged a heavy length of material onto his lap. At first it was shapeless, anonymous. A big patch pocket surfaced, then a toggle button. It was a Loden coat, fragrant with pipe tobacco. "My old one," the man said. "I just keep it in the car because I don't know what to do with it. Last year the kids gave me this goose-down thing. So you have it." Jack struggled into the big coat, putting it on right over the denim jacket. "Oh, boy," he said. It was like being embraced by a bear with a taste for Borkum Riff. "Good," the man said. "Now, if you ever find yourself standing out on a cold and windy road again, you can thank Miles P. Kiger of Ogden, Illinois, for saving your skin. Your—" Miles P. Kiger looked as though he were going to say more. The word hung in the air for a second. The man was still smiling. Then the smile warped into goofy embarrassment, and Kiger snapped his head forward. In the gray morning light, Jack saw a mottled red pattern spread out across the man's cheeks. "Your something skin? Oh, no. Your beautiful skin. Your touchable, kissable, adorable." Jack pushed his hands deep into the Loden coat's pockets and pulled the coat tightly around him. Miles P. Kiger of Ogden, Illinois, stared straight ahead. "Ahem," Kiger said. Exactly like a man in a comic book. "Thanks for the coat," Jack said. "Really, I'll be grateful to you whenever I wear it." "Sure, okay," Kiger said. "Forget it." But for a second his face was oddly like poor Donnie Keegan's back in the Sunlight home. "There's a place up ahead," Kiger said. His voice was choppy, abrupt, full of phony calm. "We can get some lunch if you like." "I don't have any money left," Jack said, a statement exactly $2.38 shy of the truth. "Don't worry about it." Kiger had already snapped on his turn indicator. They drove into a windswept, nearly empty parking lot before a low gray structure that looked like a railway car. A neon sign above the central door flashed Empire Diner. Kiger pulled up before one of the diner's long windows, and they left the car. This coat would keep him warm, Jack realized. His chest and arms seemed protected by woolen armor. Jack began to move toward the door under the flashing sign, but turned around when he realized that Kiger was still standing beside the car. The gray-haired man, only an inch or two taller than Jack, was looking at him over the car's top. "Say," Kiger said. "Look, I'd be happy to give you your coat back," Jack said. "No, that's yours now. I was just thinking I'm not really hungry, after all, and if I keep on going, I can make pretty good time, get home a little earlier." "Sure," Jack said. "You'll get another ride here. Easy, I promise. I wouldn't drop you here if you were going to be stranded." "Fine." "Hold on, I said I'd get you lunch, and I will." He put his hand in his trouser pocket, then held a bill out across the top of the car to Jack. The chill wind ruffled his hair and flattened it against his forehead. "Take it." "No, honest," Jack said. "It's okay. I have a couple of dollars." "Get yourself a good steak," Kiger said, and was leaning across the top of the car, holding out the bill,
as if offering a life preserver, or reaching for one. Jack reluctantly came forward and took the bill from Kiger's extended fingers. It was a 10. "Thanks a lot. I mean it. Here, why don't you take the paper, too? Have something to read? You know, if you have to wait a little or something?" Kiger had already opened his door and leaned inside to pluck a folded tabloid newspaper off the back seat. "I've already read it." He tossed it over to Jack. The pockets of the Loden coat were so roomy that Jack could slip the folded paper into one of them. Miles P. Kiger stood for a moment beside his open car door, squinting at Jack. "If you don't mind my saying so, you're going to have an interesting life," he said. "It's pretty interesting already," Jack said truthfully. Salisbury steak was $5.40, and it came with French fries. Jack sat at the end of the counter and opened the newspaper. The story was on the second page. The day before, he had seen it on the first page of an Indiana newspaper. "Arrests made related to shock horror deaths. Local magistrate Ernest Fairchild and police officer Frank B. Williams of Cayuga, Indiana, had been charged with misuse of public monies and acceptance of bribes in the course of the investigation of the deaths of six boys at the Sunlight Gardner Scripture Home for Wayward Boys. The popular evangelist Robert Sunlight Gardner had apparently escaped from the grounds of the home shortly before the arrival of the police, and while no warrants had as yet been issued for his arrest, he was urgently being sought for questioning. "Was he another Jim Jones?" asked a caption beneath a picture of Gardner at his most gorgeous, arms outspread, hair falling in perfect waves. Dogs had led the state police to an area near the electrified fences where boys' bodies had been buried without ceremony. Five bodies, it appeared, most of them so decomposed that identification was not possible. They would probably be able to identify Ferd Janklow. His parents would be able to give him a real burial, all the while wondering what they had done wrong exactly, all the while wondering just how their love for Jesus had condemned their brilliant, rebellious son. When the Salisbury steak came, it tasted both salty and woolly, but Jack ate every scrap and soaked up all the thick gravy with the Empire Diner's underdone fries. He had just about finished his meal when a bearded trucker with a Detroit Tigers cap shoved down over long black hair, a parka that seemed to be made from wolfskins, and a thick cigar in his mouth, paused beside him and asked, "You need a ride west, kid? I'm going to Decatur." Halfway to Springfield. Just like that. That night, in a $3-a-night hotel the trucker had told him about, Jack had two distinct dreams. Or he later remembered these two out of many that deluged his bed, or the two were actually one long joined dream. He had locked his door, peed into the stained and cracked sink in the corner, put his knapsack under his pillow, and fallen asleep holding the big marble that in the other world was a territory's mirror. There had been a suggestion of music, an almost cinematic touch, fiery, alert bebop. At a volume so low, Jack could just pick out that the lead instruments were a trumpet and an alto saxophone. "Richard," Jack drowsily thought. "Tomorrow I should be seeing Richard Sloat," and fell down the slope of the rhythm into brimming unconsciousness. Wolf was trotting toward him across a blasted, smoking landscape. Strings of barbed wire, now and then coiling up into fantastic and careless barbed wire intricacies, separated them. Deep trenches, too, divided the spoiled land, one of which Wolf vaulted easily before nearly tumbling into one of the ranks of wire. "Watch out," Jack called. Wolf caught himself before falling into the triple strands of wire. He waved one big paw to show Jack that he was unhurt, and then cautiously stepped over the wires. Jack felt an amazing surge of happiness and relief pass through him. Wolf had not died. Wolf would join him again. Wolf made it over the barbed wire and began trotting forward again. The land between Jack and Wolf seemed mysteriously to double in length. Gray smoke hanging over the many trenches almost obscured the big, shaggy figure coming forward. "Jason," Wolf shouted. "Jason, Jason. I'm still here," Jack shouted back. "Can't make it, Jason. Wolf can't make it. Keep trying," Jack bawled. "Damn it, don't give up." Wolf paused before an impenetrable tangle of wire, and through the smoke Jack saw him slip down to all fours and trot back and forth, nosing for an open place. From side to side, Wolf trotted, each time going out a greater distance, with every second becoming more evidently disturbed. Finally, Wolf stood up again and placed his hands on the thick tangle of wire and forced a space he could shout through. "Wolf can't, Jason. Wolf can't. I love you, Wolf, Jack."